This is part one of a two-part podcast.
Okay, it's on.
So, I had to start. So this is about the Natural Plasters DVD, Bart's The Art and Science of Natural Plasters. And it's a little over 2 hours long, and you got to get used to doo-doo being brought up about every 4 minutes or so.
That's just your sense of humor. You liked it. It was like a little doo-wop between scene changes.
And the first time I heard it, I thought, was that like a sound error? You know, what happened right there? And after a while, you kind of get used to it. Oh, it's like a little transition, you know, doo-doo-doo-doo-doo, and then it goes into the next thing. But it was like a doo-doo, you know, or something like that. I can't remember what it was. But it was doo-doo a lot, wasn't it? I mean, I'm not making this up, right?
It was a little, yeah, it was often they were making that noise.
Okay. All right. So it's me and Fred and Jocelyn. And, the DVD was definitely Canadian, eh?
True.
What's that all about? All right. Hey, and when the show starts up, there was a very important thing I noticed, and it said that the supreme executive producer was me. And this is the first time I've seen it. You'd think that the supreme executive producer would have his shit together a little bit better than this. Because it's now been out about a year. But it was one where it was like really, it's not me. I didn't do anything. But all the Permies people. So we sent stuff out on the Dailyish email and whatnot. And the Permies people came out and supported their Kickstarter and to like a very large number. And so that was awesome.
Right. Yeah. Bart was very excited about this. He really enjoys this instructor, Chris Magwood. Is that what it was?
I didn't see the last name.
I think it's Magwood. I'm trying to make sure I have it now. We're so prepared for this podcast.
At the end, they had the names of the people who supported the Kickstarter. And so all these names are going by. And then it goes by Chris's dad.
That was good.
Yeah. All right.
Yes, Chris Magwood, The Art and Science of Natural Plaster.
Okay. And somewhere I got their website. Is that, you have it up there?
I'm at possiblemedia.org, which is a lot of what Bart's been doing now. There's several films there now. I thought I saw they announced a website, a natural plaster website.
Yes, plasterscience.com.
Ah, okay.
There, I had to go look it up in my notes.
Good.
All right. I thought it was really good. Now, my entire knowledge of working with plasters is either A, working with Cobb, where I never, ever did any of the finishing layers. It was all just rough cob work. And or when I was a teenager and a little bit when I was a young adult, then I did a bunch of stuff with drywall where you go in and you put the mud on, the white mud.
Right.
So that's – and, of course, oodles, way too much painting. I've done all the painting I ever want to do for the rest of my life. From when I was young. So that's my experience with plasters, which he kind of said that the mud that you use for drywalling is in many ways kind of similar to a lot of this. And I don't know what that mud was made out of. It was always a white powder, which we mixed with water.
Well, he said it was a kind of plaster, and he defined a plaster as an aggregate, a binder, and fiber.
Fiber, which right. I always kind of, the fiber I always included as an aggregate. It's a fiber aggregate.
Yeah.
So there's aggregate, which is typically sand or rocks, you know, but I suppose it could be all kinds of things. And in fact, we use perlite for our cobbish to be an aggregate, a very lightweight aggregate. Yeah. And then fiber aggregate is going to be stuff that's, you know, anywhere from an eighth of an inch long to maybe 3 or 4 inches long. And then it helps prevent cracking. So it kind of, as everything dries or cures, then it helps to make it much, much stronger if you've added a fiber aggregate. But anyway, but we get an, well, no, that's right at the beginning. Here, that's my next note. So the binder for cob is clay. Uh-huh. So it's sticky. And then when it dries, it kind of is almost like a kind of glue, sort of, kind of, hence the word binder. But one of the things he talked about is that there's basically, for when it comes to the natural plasters, there's pretty much two kinds. And I wanted him, from the very beginning, he mentioned it a little bit at the very, very end. But at the very, very beginning, I'm kind of thinking to myself, like, he's talking about a lime plaster or a clay plaster. And those seem to be the two that he focused on. Am I leaving anything out? Clay?
That was the big division that he made.
Yeah.
Right. Well, and he mostly, my sense in retrospect, is that he mostly talked about plasters you would use to create a wall. And he went into, you know, whether it's a structural wall, but it was more like a finish wall. Instead of putting up drywall and paint, you would put up your plaster, like the rougher plaster and then the finished plaster. And he kind of went over some natural paints that you could then put on top. You could either pigment your finished plaster and or put a paint on top of that finished plaster. I kept thinking of plasters, you know, I keep thinking of the paints, the natural paints, as part of the plaster genre, for lack of a better term. But he mostly, it was like the structural plaster and the finished plasters, and that's what it was. And he mostly showed working with clay, the clay plasters.
Right. I appreciate that. Most, in fact, he kind of seemed to suggest, well, the thing I wanted to hear at the very beginning was like, why would you choose one over the other? Why? And instead of kind of going into, like, he wanted to lay his foundation and then draw the conclusions during the conclusion at the end. That's how he wanted to kind of go about it. And so basically I'm going to jump to the end and I'm going to say the why is that he gave is that usually for stuff that's outside, he's going to go with the lime plasters. And then for the stuff that's on the inside, he tends to go with the clay plasters. And it sounds like the lime plasters tend to do better with repelling water or dealing with weather. And it's because they have, as they age, then they get stronger.
Right.
And, it's a chemical bond. And so it's like, oh, okay. Whereas, of course, clay, you get enough water on it, it turns back into mud, which can be really inconvenient if it rains a lot where you are. Now, some of what he talked about, too, is having like a big eave over the walls, which is what we tend to do here with the Wafatis. Mm-hmm. So that way it could be outside. And then if it's outside, and you got a big eave, it's like it's got to be some seriously driving horizontal rain that's going to hit the wall and get it to dissolve. But then we even go into some stuff about that, about things you could put on top of that to help make it be a little bit more weatherproof.
Well, one of the things that he was saying, why use one or the other, is that an advantage with clay is that if you need to mend a crack or something, you just wet it and you can make a repair. Whereas with the lime plaster, it's hardened and it's a little trickier to repair those kinds of things. If you need to change your wall at all, you can just wet the clay plaster. And one thing he did talk about at the beginning that he didn't mention at the end was that the lime plasters have much higher embodied energy.
Now, and that's right when he started talking about that, because I know like Erica's been here a lot, and Erica talks about these plasters a lot. Not only for the cob-based rocket mass heaters that are here, but also for a variety of other things. For all kinds of projects, and when you sit down and you have time to visit with Ernie and Erica, then of course there's a massive knowledge base there, and we get to, you know, hash through it all. But Erica is frequently talking about milk paints and also, you know, lime plasters. And we start talking about things like, okay, we're going to do something with a shower or do something with a tub, something that's going to hold water. Or we're going to do something, we're going to build something outside and how to get it to last outside, you know, because it's made out of cob. Things of that nature. So I've heard a lot of this stuff from Erica, but lime plasters, I mean, there was a point in time that I assumed that gardener's lime was nothing other than limestone, and I was wrong. I mean, basically, lime is calcium. But then I saw a thing, some kind of YouTube video that was about like a BBC thing, like, let's all go and live 300 years ago, and here's what you did. And it's like, okay, now your soil's too acidic, you need to add some lime. But you got to take your, and I believe what they did is they took limestone, and it's like, you just can't put limestone on the ground, that isn't going to work. And I thought, really? I thought that's exactly what I want to do. And I was like, no, you got to put it in this giant kiln and burn it for 3 days. What? Why would you do that? And somehow it puts some kind of energy into it. And then they go and they dump it on the fields. And I believe, and I can't remember if I got this correctly, but they call it, now it is slaked lime. And so then my understanding is the lime that they're using typically has two different flavors. Hydrated lime, which is when they burned it, then they added water, and then they took the water out. which is kind of like, why would you do that?
The hydration is part of the process somehow with the burning, and I don't understand it.
Well, you've gone back to talking about the two kinds of lime for plaster, not what you were just talking about a second ago and the lime for agricultural purposes.
Which is like, I'm trying to sort this out, and I don't know. And it's like, and I'm learning how ignorant I am as I, you know, go further into this. But okay, the second kind of lime, of course, is the hydraulic lime, which apparently comes exclusively from Europe. And it's already apparently, you know, pre-charged, I suppose. But apparently you can't get it. Like it doesn't occur naturally in the United States, but it does occur naturally in Europe. So yeah, you're right. I wandered off into this space. But as I'm watching this video, I'm thinking about this, like when we say, I mean, then of course, it has nothing to do with a lime tree and the little green fruit that's sour mm-hmm. like lemons. Mm-hmm. That's a totally different thing, which we're going to leave out for now. I'm going to shake this microphone just to annoy you.
He holds the microphone in a hand and then starts gesturing like an Italian. It doesn't look good for the mic or the sound quality. I'm trying to help.
This is Scottish heritage gesturing here.
So the sound gets louder and quieter with each rotation of the hand.
We're going to learn the Doppler effect in a whole new way. All right. So there's a bunch of embodied energy in lime. And I think it comes from you put the heat in, and then it's ready to do a chemical bond. It's you know, but that's another thing too, is that he mentions in the video that you can burn yourself with lime. Watch out.
It's caustic. Yeah. It's caustic. It does not feel good on the skin or the eyes.
But also, when you add water to the hydrated lime, it releases a lot of heat, and you can actually physically burn yourself or melt a container if you're doing it in plastic and you add the wrong proportions.
I did not know that.
We didn't talk about that in the video.
Yeah, you had read about this.
I read the
stuff.
Natural Plaster book.
Okay.
Which I can't remember.
This guy wrote.
No, it's
different author. But so he was giving a big overview, and he talked about how complicated the natural plaster spaces, and you wanted more of the chemistry and the science behind the limes. He was giving an overview of kind of...
This is my job. This is how I do it.
Well, no, I wanted to back up kind of to what you were saying, your kind of spoiler that he likes the clay inside and he likes the lime outside. In the beginning, he talked about the reasons to use natural plasters, and he talks about the toxicity all the way through somewhat.
Yeah.
And it's a toxicity thing. He also, I think there's an aesthetic he truly, truly enjoys and masters with the natural plasters. They're just wholly different from having drywall in your house or something like that. But, and he didn't talk about that. He just demonstrated that. But he talked about how adding, you know, 3 inches of natural plaster to the inside of your wall adds thermal mass. He talked about.
Well, he said an inch, if you had an inch.
Oh, okay. Well, whatever it ends up. He was demonstrating like 3 inches almost. No?
No.
Not that much?
No. I think he said it was 3/4 of an inch is what we saw. It was pretty thick.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it adds to the thermal mass, which helps with heating and cooling. He also said that while it is breathable, and that way it can take in moisture, so it's a bit susceptible to moisture, he also felt it makes your home more airtight than drywall does. So he felt for energy efficiency, it was kind of more airtight, but it's still a breathable thing.
Yeah.
So he was talking about all of those up at the beginning, and then he was comparing the embodied energy, which I think a lot of people truly appreciate with what they're using to build with.
The breathable and more airtight thing, I think is a really good point. And of course, uh-huh. with conventional homes, they do the thing where they put all the plastic in.
Right.
And then it makes it too airtight. So then they put holes in your walls.
Yep.
And so I remember you were living someplace where
they did that,
where it was too airtight. So the guys came through and they put in like everybody's house.
They put holes
in the walls, and you could literally see outside.
You could.
Through the hole in the wall.
They were the strangest vents I've ever seen in a building before.
And then, and then your folks, they had a house that was also airtight. And, I remember we would be sitting at their table and I'd hear a fan come on and like, what's with that fan that comes on? And it's like, oh, our house is too airtight. So this fan has to come on once an hour for 10 minutes to like suck all the stinkums out.
Yeah.
Or else we could all die.
It's so funny.
And it's like, this one, they said we don't have to have the plastic in the walls because the walls are breathable. But at the same time, it's more airtight because, you know, you basically are living inside of a terracotta jar, sort of.
Sort of.
You know,
you push the clay into all the little cracks that air might go through. So.
Yeah. No. Yeah. So it's breathable, but airtight. And I kind of thought, man, that's marketing for you right there. The air whips right through, except when it doesn't. And so I thought that was a pretty good point.
Mm-hmm. So I found it on Google. The Natural Plaster book was written by Cedar Rose Goldberth.
That sounds like a totally different name than Chris.
It does. So, yeah, he didn't write this book, but that's a different review. We can look at that book.
Oh, okay. Later. Okay. All right.
But yeah, Fred was already had some of this information under his belt before watching the movie.
Okay. Working with plaster. Another thing is like, in this DVD, they're demonstrating the plaster in a straw bale house.
Uh-huh.
So then when you're all done, you generally don't leave it to be just straw bales. And so then you're going to cover it with some kind of plaster. Now, I think another place you'd use it is with a cob house.
Of course.
And those are like our two biggest natural building styles.
He briefly showed a snippet of a lathe and plaster.
That's true. That's old school. So like I once, rented a house that had that.
Hmm.
And that brings up a really good point. It's like you can't put a nail anywhere. It's like you could try to put a nail in and you get a chunk of wall, for your effort, which doesn't look good. Now you got to attach something to the wall to cover up the chunk you just kind of made there. And that's another thing is like, if you've got a cob wall, or a straw bale wall, which you've now, you know, done this natural plaster over, you're not putting nails up anywhere. Now, I've read a lot of books about Cobb and Straubel, and of course, what a lot of them will do is that they'll take a 1x4 and attach a bunch of staples and screws and nails and shit to one side of it, and then they'll kind of attach that to the wall. And so all that, so while they're making the wall, the idea is you're going to end up with this wood strip at a certain height, which is about where you're going to hang maybe some of your paintings or something.
Yeah.
Your decorative items.
Well, the house I lived at in Minnesota was the plaster and lath, and there's a top trim at the crown molding. I don't know what it's called, but there's hooks that they used to make, which are now uncommon because all houses are drywall now. But then you would just hook onto that and hang down, and that's what you would mount your pictures on. So you never had to put a hole in the wall. You just hung it to the
But there'd always
to
be
the
this
crown
little,
molding. Yeah.
There'd always be this little line that would go up from your picture to the top.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, if you're building anything with this stuff, they should have mentioned that in here, too. Now, with the Wafati, we're going to be using a fair amount of this kind of stuff because we're going to put Cobb in between a lot of the logs and then, do your finishing layers with your different colors and stuff, which we're going to get to later. But, you leave a little bit of the log exposed. That way you always have a place to put a nail in if you need to or attach something if you need to. So, but try to go into a bathroom and put up a towel rack and the walls are that cement plaster.
Well, I think that's where you would just build that in. Build it in, whether it's crown molding or build it in as a chair rail or build something in between the two, kind of like in an Amish home where they have the racks to hang all the dining room chairs on when they clean. So you just build something like that in.
So if you arrive to a home and it's not already built in, then what you're suggesting is take out that wall and rebuild the wall. Duh. The idea of evolving as you go along, that's not part of that wall design. You either rebuild the entire wall, if you want to have a towel rack, that's going to be a 4-day job now rather than a 4-minute job.
Well, it depends. If it's lime plaster, maybe more than 4 days. If it's Cobb, maybe, a couple days to soften up the Cobb and chip it out and then...
Well, now, the ones that we're talking about with the lath, those were cement. Mine was cement. What was yours?
It was some kind of plaster. I don't know if it was cement, but it was 100. It was 100 years old, so I don't know.
Yeah.
It was kind of crumbly.
Okay. I think mine was probably cement, I'm not sure either. Maybe it was something else.
Right. He did mention that, of course, cement can be one of the binders in a plaster. I mean, when you're just talking about generic plasters... Especially steccos and things like that. Typically, the binder is a type of cement.
Yeah. Which is what we're trying to, one of the things we're trying to get away from for a variety of reasons, including how it's got so much embodied energy. And then we're back to the lime plasters.
Mm-hmm. He even talked about the embodied energy and using clay plasters if you're not getting it from your site and you're buying manufactured clays. They've been fired in a kiln and ground up and shipped thousands of miles. That, that is quite a bit of energy if you're not just going out and putting your shovels into the ground nearby.
Yeah, any of what he called the processed materials have the embodied energy. So, yeah, that was interesting. And then plus, he even talked about, the finer materials are obviously nicer for more of a finished plaster. But if you're really trying to do more of a structural base plaster, it has more integrity and more strength if you have coarser materials. So a coarser sand or aggregate, whatever you're using as your aggregate, if that's coarser and if the clay is coarser and the straw, you can't have it overly coarse, but all of those coarse materials help with the integrity of the coarser plaster. I thought he explained that well. And he repeated himself a lot with that, but I found that useful.
And I think this is the kind of thing that's also true for Cobb floors, as well as what we just saw. So they had, first, for the layers, real quick, and I kind of wish they'd done this summary from the beginning. It would have been helpful to me. So they had the straw bale, and then they had to go and use kind of a straw and clay mix to kind of shove in between the straw bales, like where two straw bales would meet. They would try to fill that and level it out a bit with something that looked like it was about half straw and half clay. So it was a very straw-intensive glob.
Yeah.
And so then you had this wall that looked like it was a polka dot wall, where the straw and clay globs were the polka dots. And then it seems like the next thing he did was is he had to put on a layer of just clay on all of that. That was pretty
wet. Was
it clay
and sand?
I think it was a plaster without the fiber.
Okay.
Exactly. So you're saying it's clay and sand. I thought he was saying that it was pretty much just clay. And then the idea was is that this is going to, because he showed that if you just took, because after this layer comes the main layer, which I can't remember what he called that layer. But it had the straw in it. And he kind of showed, if you try to take this and you try to stick it onto the straw right now, it just doesn't really stick. But if you take this layer that I thought was pretty much, I thought it was just clay. I thought it was just clay. But maybe it was clay and sand. And then he would kind of smear it on. Then it would it would stay.
Right. He said some people will call that your discovery coat. It's just you kind of figure out the highs and lows of your wall whenever you're putting that coat on. It's not a thick layer at all. It just follows the contours of the wall that you've already made.
Right.
And especially with the straw, it helped even that out because the main plaster wouldn't stick to just the straw quite well enough.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so the main plaster, which just seemed like cob to me, that would be, and it did have a fair bit of straw in it. Like sometimes cob doesn't have any straw in it, but this, he was emphatic about it. They used a lot of straw.
Half by volume, he said, half straw.
And then that went on next, and that was probably about a half an inch.
He had a lot of really good tips on mixing, and I might be jumping ahead a little bit, but, you know, they used a chipper or something to cut up the straw. They used a mortar mixer, not a cement mixer, and he talked about having things right height for your wheelbarrow, having your clay there, your sand there, and a lot of really good tips there. He's done just a bit of this. And I think that was about the time that I saw him plaster an entire wall while five students plastered half a wall just next to him.
Which I think that's kind of a common thing.
Oh, sure.
It's like when you're trying to build a rocket mass heater by yourself versus when Ernie and Erica are there.
Yeah.
Now, I've built some rocket mass heaters by myself, and I thought it went, you know, pretty good, pretty quick. But, when Ernie and Eric are there, it does go a lot faster because they've built so many.
So I interrupted you talking about the layers. You talked about the clay and the straw shoved in the holes, like the pockets.
So you could call that a layer, sort of.
And then, well, each one is a substrate of the next one. So he kept using the word substrate. And I was kind of wishing it had distinct names, like you would name layers of the soil.
And he probably does have names for that. And I just didn't write them down.
No,
but the next layer was kind of a clay schmear. And then I think Fred's room like clay and sand.
Reveal layer.
Is that what he called it, reveal? I know I've heard it called discovery.
Discovery, that's what he said.
He said that.
Discovery layer.
Some people will call it discovery. He called it something else, though.
Okay.
Yeah. So there was the filler, the discovery, and then the main.
The main layer is probably half an inch thick.
High body or something. I don't remember what
it is. That's the one where you kind of de-lumpify everything. At that point, you're setting what is the shape. And so...
But it's a rough, it's the shape, but it's rough because it has the high straw content. It's a rough surface because of the high straw.
I mean, I thought the surface looked pretty good to me.
Mm-hmm. Oh, they did beautiful work.
But it was, and it did have a lot of straw in it, but it looked good. Then came the next layer, which is going to be a finer layer, and it helps to, it's a finishing layer. Finish
plaster.
And then came the final layer, which is the color. It has the color in it. So how many layers is that?
Sometimes.
Five? Is that five layers?
One, two, three, four, five. Yeah, sometimes the finish plaster can also have the pigment, so it might be your last layer. But
he pointed out, then you got to go through a lot more pigment. And the pigment can be expensive. Uh-huh. And so it sounds like, and then he kind of talked about how a lot of times, unlike paint will give up after a certain amount of time and start to peel off or rub off or whatever. But he was pointing out that with these plasters, that's generally not the case. It will generally last an exceptionally long time.
Right. He was especially talking about one, like a mineral one, particularly they found lasted 15 years, a silicate paint, which is a silicate minerals paint. They put that on an exterior, I believe, and it lasted 15 years.
Chemically bonds with the plaster underneath, so then it's not like it's a separate layer.
Yeah, it doesn't flake or peel because it's become one, huh? Mm-hmm. But yeah, there could theoretically be six layers because, you know, you have the hole filling layer, you have the discovery layer, you have the main plaster layer, you have a finished plaster, you may do a paint. And if you're doing a natural paint, he said sometimes those are kind of dull-ish, especially once they dry. So some people might coat that with linseed oil. So that would be a sixth layer, if I've counted correctly.
And whenever Erica talks about using linseed oil, mm-hmm. and I've got some linseed oil notes coming up later, then she's kind of talking about the stink of it. And it's like, yeah, you don't want to be in there for weeks. It's going to...
Well, yeah, he talked about lots of different things. And again, I may have jumped ahead a little bit too much, but, you know, you could mix some linseed oil in with your paint or your finished plaster. And then for exterior, he really liked siloxane as a top coat on the exterior pigments or the exterior paint or finished plaster layer.
Okay, you're way ahead of me on notes.
I know.
You're way ahead of me.
I know.
So one of the things he pointed out was that when working with plaster, then you get to see a human-created element or aesthetic, which you don't normally get with paints. Now, I remember in, you know, the days that I did drywall with my dad, then it's like, okay, we, you know, you go and you put the drywall up, and then you go and you stick the mud in the cracks, and we've got a bunch of techniques for the interior corners, the exterior corners, you know, and then there's like a tape that you put up between the cracks, and you fill it, and we'll usually do three layers of mud to get it perfectly smooth, and we'll come back in and sand on it. Sometimes if we didn't do a good job mudding, then you had to make up for it with sanding later. And then when it's all smooth, 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 then you think, oh, now you put the paint on. And it's like, no. Then you go and you get the splatter gun thing.
To
put the texture on it. And it spits a stupid texture all over it. Then you wait for that to dry. And then you put a coat of paint on that. And, of course, you get your standard generic white wall. And it's like, we always use the exact same color for every wall we ever did. We never did an interesting color of any kind. It was always off-white. Always.
Right.
The exact same off-white. So there were some weird projects that we did where we were allowed to actually use colors, but most of the time it was always off-white.
Yeah, he said that natural plasters can eliminate machines, because you're not, you know, all that drywall is all made by machines. And
yeah,
but I think the wall that he was demonstrating on, that was a curved wall that was done with straw bale. Mm-hmm. Which straw bale isn't really up for curved walls too much, but it was a curved straw bale wall, and it did look really pretty. Mm-hmm. But there was also a lot of work that went into it. Now, so he's trying to say a human element. And at Cobb Cottage, oh, wow. those were some beautiful structures. Now, of course, cob, you can shape it into anything you want. Unlike straw bales, which are basically, you know, you can make it as long as, if you can make it with Legos, you can make it with straw bale. Although straw bale walls do tend to have at least a little bit of curve to them, and that's part of what gives them some extra strength. But the cob structures at Cobb Cottage were really amazingly beautiful, and I could kind of see how a lot of people would say, would change their mind to say something like, yeah, I'll give up living in this 2,500 square foot home in exchange for a home that's one third the size, but is this living piece of art.
Yeah. Yeah, you could see that he had a high level of skill, and even though he was making something that he considered hand-built, and he preferred putting the plaster on by hand initially, but then smoothing it with tools after that. And yet he had such a lovely, lovely finish to it that while it was handmade, it was artisan handmade, it looked like to me.
I think the stuff at Cobb Cottage looked kind of lumpy.
Mm-hmm.
And
this,
but that was
not so much.
Yeah. what we saw today, it was like, okay, now here's what we're going to do. We're going to make this wall like perfectly smooth, which I think in itself is a bit of an art form to pull off. And they did a very good job of it. And they kept having video segments of him sitting in front of a wall somewhere that was fabulously colored and extremely flat, and sometimes with slight color variations. And a lot of this, I was kind of thinking to myself, like, man, I feel like in order to really get into this video, you got to be an interior decorator. And I'm not an interior decorator. So I felt like I wasn't really qualified to be watching this, but I am glad to know what the techniques are.
Right.
Especially since we start getting into some things where we're like, okay, at Allerton Abbey, then we're getting to the point where we're putting the final touches in there to finish it. But like right now, we don't even have a floor in there. The floor is dirt, and then we've done an ailer floor on it, which is to lay down a layer of plastic and a layer of carpet on that. Which ailer kind of feels like there's no other way. That is the only way you're allowed to have a floor.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of feeling like, no, we can go with the Cobb floor. You can go with the Tadillac. And that was another thing. I was kind of hoping they were going to talk about floors in this video, and they never did.
Right. Well, it's a complicated space. And he fully demonstrated the basic clay plaster and the clay finish plaster on a straw bale wall, I feel like. And when he started talking about plasters, and you know, he went through some very, very basic things that he did explanation wise and not demonstration wise, but so many of us grew up with framed houses that were just painted with regular house paints that use a chemical bond. They're the drywall and the texturing you've described, and then people roll or brush paint on that, and that forms a chemical bond. And then you have all the off-gassing in your house, right? But he talked about if you're using clay plasters and lime plasters, he said there needs to be a mechanical grip. The lime does do more of a chemical reaction, but it's more
chemical
in the
bond.
Yeah, but it's more of a chemical hardening, I think, than that. He said for plasters, natural plasters, you need a mechanical grip, because it's not, that's the best thing. And so he went through all the ways you do a mechanical grip, and that's, you know, if you're doing clay on straw, there's little grippies, you know, it's textured. That's what the mechanical grip is.
It's the straw itself, which
yeah.
is tied to the rest of the straw in a big bale, which goes all the way through a yeah. rather thick wall.
Right. But then if you're moving from one plaster layer to the next, you actually do score the plaster to give it a mechanical grip. And he said that, like, if you have a really, really flat surface, like a conventional drywall type surface, that even if it's supposedly textured, it's still fairly flat. He said you basically could make your own glue, like a wheat paste glue or something like that, with some sand in it, and put that on a crazy flat surface, and then that's your mechanical grip. So he talked, he said there is a chemical bond that happens too with some of this stuff, but mostly the mechanical grip is the best. And the transition points need extra grip. He talked a lot about the meshes that you use, too, for the transition points.
Right, the transition points where it's like, okay, we're going to there's going to be a door here, or a window here, or a floor, mm-hmm. or a mm-hmm. ceiling. There's going to be something else here. And he had an interesting, mildly elaborate thing. And, well, elaborate might not be the right word. So basically, you've got your piece of wood that's going to be your transition point. And later, there'll be fancy wood put over that. But for your transition point wood, then it would be backed by a piece of plastic or tarp. And over the plastic or tarp, there would be mesh. And he talked at length about different kinds of mesh. And one of the things I thought was interesting is that he seemed to advocate, don't use metal. So what he used was metal.
No, so it was fiberglass.
What? Weren't you just telling us not to use it? Well, it looked like it was metal mesh that he was using.
He said
don't use metal. Because metal, and I thought this was really good, is that it will expand and contract at a rate that's different than the natural plaster.
Yeah.
Which sounded like, and therefore, it will decompose quickly. But you're saying that
he said
the
transition
was using not metal? Because it looked like metal to me.
He said he prefers fiberglass or polypropylene mesh.
Right.
He said even the stainless steel mesh will rust, and as well as expand and contraction thing. And the thing you're describing with the wood and the mesh, and he explained, I forget why he said that, why he had that bit of plastic there too.
I thought the plastic they put there was really interesting, because it's like at that point, it's a transition area, so here's where you might lose your that part where he's talking about how the walls breathe, but mm-hmm. they're totally airtight.
Right.
So it's like that might suddenly be a real strong breathing space.
Right.
Now where it's one good thing about the breathing versus being airtight, I'm kind of thinking like in Allerton Abbey for a while, we didn't have a door. It's like that door is under construction. And so that's when the chipmunks are like, hey, check it out. This is a great place to live. And so when everything is airtight, you know, or at least, you know, all cobbed in, then at least you can look around the room and say, fucking chipmunks aren't getting in here.
Right.
I think that's, and then also, you know, I suppose if there's bugs outside or something like that, and that was another thing I was thinking about, like a lot of places where they're doing all these really, really cool things, they have bugs. Oh man, have they got bugs. And I'm kind of thinking like, we are very fortunate in that we really don't have bugs. compared to those places, so like, in fact, Fred, you said you found like 3 ticks on you this year.
Yeah.
But then you also told me a story of like being in, I believe, Minnesota.
Yeah, I was one day in Minnesota. I think the most ticks I ever found on me was 100.
100 in one day.
I stopped counting after 100.
In Minnesota. And so here, all year this year, which now we're
maybe it's been more since then, but.
We're in the middle of tick season.
Yeah, now it's been 4.
Oh, 4, okay.
And last year it was 0.
Last year, yeah. So like last year, I think I had 0 last year, I think. And I had 1 this year so far.
The one I found crawling across your forehead.
Yeah, I was looking for those eyebrows to latch into. But I think most people who come here experience 0. And I think your report of 4 in 1 year, I think, sets the record. I think the most I've heard of anybody getting is 3 for the entire year. So, all right. So bugs, when you make it relatively airtight with Cobb, you've got a pretty good confidence level that bugs are not getting in, unless, of course, in this transition space, you forgot to put a little bit of plastic and then this little bit of mesh. Now, and then this is in response to, I brought it up that I thought the mesh that he was using, looking at the video we just saw, I thought it was metal. Am I the only one that thinks that?
It looked like
metal, but I don't know what fiberglass mesh looks like.
It looks white and shiny.
Okay. It did not look like fiberglass then.
No, it looked like metal. He said, I do recall him saying he prefers fiberglass or polypropylene. And I don't know that he showed a picture of the fiberglass then, if from what you're describing. But I just keep trying to spit out that these bits of wood with the strip of mesh and the strip of plastic attached to it, he called them plaster stops.
Yep.
Yeah.
Or transition.
Yeah. Well, sometimes there'd be a different kind of transition than a plaster stop. Like he did have nice curved window wells that didn't always have a plaster stop. And so, but through some kind of transition like that, I think underneath there he might have had mesh.
I think another thing to point out is this video is over 2 hours long, because part of me kind of thinks like, I wanted to see him put in those window wells because they were really beautiful and everything. And like, okay, well, what'd you do there? But of course, it's over 2 hours long. Something had to be trimmed out.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry, I took away your train of thought there. This podcast is continued in part 2.